Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. As Black History Month comes to a close, this week we're going to visit with some of the contributors to the New York Times groundbreaking 1619 Project here on The Brian Lehrer Show. 1619, as in the year enslaved Africans first arrived in what became United States territory. So let's start there with one of the contributors to the project, Nikita Stewart, New York Times reporter who usually covers social services in New York City Hall, whose essay is called "Why Can't We Teach Slavery Right in American Schools?" Hey, Nikita, thanks so much for coming in. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me again.
So we see from your reporting in 2017, the Southern Poverty Law Center examined over 12 popular U.S. history books, surveyed more than 1,700 social studies teachers and 1,000 high school seniors on how slavery is taught in America. Did their findings surprise you?
I guess the findings didn't surprise me, but of course they were disturbing. 8%, only 8% of high school seniors could identify slavery as the central cause of the Civil War.
Wow.
It was the cause. Through the years, before the Civil War, during the Civil War, post-Civil War, there was this concerted effort to, lessen the brutality of slavery and the reality of slavery. And then in later years, there was a real propaganda to make the South look good and make the North look good. Soon teachers were describing the cause of the Civil War as being about states' rights.
One of the major issues I see is that in some states, they still teach from the so-called lost cause perspective. For our listeners who may not be familiar, can you talk about what that theory is and why it's problematic in education?
Right. Well, the lost causes, again, goes back to states' rights. It's, when you see the Confederate flag waving and we talk about these great Confederate generals, it goes back to this lost cause doctrine, which was that the cause was the South trying to assert its rights from the big bad North. And unfortunately, that has stuck with us and continues to be a part of the education. Even if the textbooks do change somewhat, remember that we have generations of teachers who have been taught the lost cause, so they pass that on to their students currently.
And you write about how, in some cases, parents and teachers of young children bungle history around slavery because they're afraid of frightening children.
Yes, this is true, especially for the very young children. It's Black History Month, so I'm sure many students are learning about good abolitionists and brave enslaved people who escaped. But, they talk about escaping and they talk about, being against slavery, but they don't really explain to children what slavery was and its current effects. And also, I can remember being a kindergartner and learning all of the presidents. And when you're learning the presidents and the founding fathers, you certainly don't learn about how they, enslaved people. We have a long way to go with that because white parents don't want their children to feel like they've done something wrong. And you know, even in the case of black parents, some black parents do not want their children to feel like they are victims or to be traumatized. So it's a difficult subject, but the Southern Poverty Law Center has actually come up with some curriculum around kindergarten through fifth grade.
You note that the vast majority of teachers in this country are white. Can you talk a little bit about how the race of the teacher can impact what students know about slavery?
Yes. You know, the other night I actually did a webinar for PBS, and there were two black teachers on the panel, and they talked about kind of shouldering the burden of teaching slavery to their students because they're not getting it from their other teachers in school. And that's what happens. And then we only learn about it during Black History Month. I think that the fact that 80% of teachers are white and also grew up with these textbooks that perpetuated states' rights as the cause of slavery is obviously problematic. But it starts with things like the 1619 Project, where we can have new conversations and look at history in a different way.
And you talk to social studies specialists who are aware that there's little standardization within the way these histories are taught. What were the recommendations for how slavery can be taught more completely in the United States and whether that can be dealt with at a national level?
Well, as far as the national level is concerned, I'm not sure we'll ever get to the point where there is an agreed upon curriculum like there is in like math and reading. I think there can be more conversations about how textbooks are selected. Also, teaching, integrating slavery throughout teaching history and social studies, because we tend to teach slavery as a section rather than as part of the founding of this country and then continuing to modern day policies and laws and prejudices. That's the only way we're going to get to the point of students really understanding, what slavery was and how it affected this country is to integrate it throughout the lessons that teachers are currently teaching.
And so, listeners, as Black History Month comes to a close all this week, we're going to visit with some of the contributors to the New York Times groundbreaking 1619 Project here on The Brian Lehrer Show. We just kicked it off with Nikita Stewart from The Times, who I will also mention has a forthcoming book called Troop 6000, The Girl Scout Troop That Began in a Shelter and Inspired the World. Do you have a release date?
Yes, May 19th. And today happens to be the anniversary of the first meeting of Troop 6000. And they're trying to sell 6,000 boxes of cookies. So look for them on Twitter and buy some cookies.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as Black History Month comes to a close this week, we're closing the show each day with contributors to the New York Times 1619 Project. 1619 as in the year enslaved Africans first arrived in what became the United States. Joining me now is Khalil Gibran Muhammad, professor at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard and author of the book The Condemnation of Blackness. Some of you will remember he was director of the New York Public Library Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture here in the city in Harlem. His essay for the 1619 Project is called The Barbaric History of Sugar in America. Professor Muhammad, great to have you on again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian.
When people think of crops that fueled slavery, most people may think first of cotton. Can you tell us why you wrote about sugar?
Well, because sugar came before cotton in terms of creating the possibility for the British colonies to thrive in the first place. Christopher Columbus brought to stalks of cane with him from the Azores Islands in 1493 on his second voyage. And as everyone knows, the whole world changed as a result. So sugar was here before cotton, and in many ways underwrote financially the wealth of the British colonies along with the Spanish and French colonies.
How did the practice of slavery shape the place of sugar as a commodity?
Well, because sugar in many ways was the most labor-intensive of the commodities. Sugar as a product of cane cultivation goes back to literally 10,000 years ago, and India was one of the first countries to develop sugar as a kind of luxury item. And by 1000 AD, it was not uncommon in Europe, but it took massive amounts of land and labor and semi-tropical conditions to make cane thrive, and therefore the possibility for sugar production as a global commodity really didn't take root until the 16th and 17th centuries.
That's a fascinating history for something that is seen as so ubiquitous and generally available today. We think first about slavery in the South, but you write that by the early to mid-1700s, sugar was already a huge moneymaker in British New York. So how did enslavement-made sugar impact New York's economy?
Well, sure. Well, first of all, everyone knows that New York City was a global city. And as such, just about every other ship entering the New York East Harbor was carrying sugar and slaves. The appetite for sugar had already been cultivated, particularly in places like Cuba, Barbados, Jamaica, 100 years before the mid-1700s. So it wasn't as if New Yorkers weren't already using it in their diet. Also, molasses was a big part of creating rum. And so the entire Atlantic economy in many ways was being shaped by the ubiquity of these sugar islands. In New York, what essentially happens is slaves are coming in to feed the domestic household economy of slavery and the building of Wall Street and so much else in the city. And sugar's coming with them. But at the same time, New Yorkers are exporting grain crops, building materials, shipping materials as part of a broader transatlantic slave economy.
You write about how much of the sugar was and still is grown and refined in Louisiana. Now, Louisiana, as you tell us, was also home to one of the largest revolts of enslaved people in U.S. history. What was that rebellion?
Yeah, so this is fascinating. I have to admit, and I imagine many of your listeners just never heard of the German Coast Uprising. It took place in 1811. It took place essentially about an hour outside of New Orleans by today's standards, by driving. And several leaders of an African-American or enslaved African community got together, convinced others to strike out against their enslavers, and something like 200 to 500 estimates range, people took arms against their enslavement. Their goal, best we can tell, was to make it to New Orleans as a kind of liberation army. The leader of this group was a man named Charles Desland, who has Creole roots. Some speculated that he was brought to the United States at the turn of the 19th century in the wake of the Haitian Revolution, which was another form of a slavery uprising, but also a sugar rebellion. They were put down pretty quickly. 100 were executed, and their heads were cut off and put as spikes all around the plantation economy from New Orleans all the way up to the sugar plantations.
If it was that intense, and if people know about any enslaved people's rebellion, it's probably the one led by Nat Turner in 1831. But if the number of participants in the Louisiana one was nearly twice as high as the number in Nat Turner's more famous 1831 rebellion, and it had that kind of grotesque ending that you just described, why did it get comparatively lost to history?
Well, we don't know exactly, and I spent a lot of time looking at what historians who have dug through the archives and the proceedings of what took place when people were being punished for all of this, and it's not clear. What we do know is that federal troops participated in the execution and the putting down of the rebellion. And so it's possible that as early as 1811, when this happened, because it was such a massive show of resistance to slavery, the idea was that it could be infectious. purchase. This was much closer to the Haitian Revolution, which had only ended a decade before. The French had lost. And so one theory would be that there was a conspiracy of silence so as not to inspire other kinds of revolts.
Mm. Today, sugar is linked to a range of health concerns, of course, like diabetes and obesity and cancer. And as you note, Black Americans have diabetes at a significantly higher rate than other Americans. How do you see the arc of that history of how African Americans were first exploited for labor in the sugar industry and how now the descendants of those enslaved people are suffering the health consequences of the same crop?
Yeah, I mean, another way to put that is to say that African Americans have always been on the short end of a cane stalk, from literally from farm to table. I mean, one way to think about sugar is that the Industrial Revolution in many ways thrived because sugar was a way of feeding workers, particularly on both sides of the Atlantic, in British cities as well as in New England ones. When those factories started to rev up and people were working 12 hours a day, sugar became a way to give them a little bit of energy boost in the middle of the day. So, but we know, of course, scientifically, based on how sugar is metabolized in our bodies, that it's actually the wrong kind of energy. And as such, those empty calories were cheap. And that cheap food became processed food in the 20th century. We have great evidence now that big sugar, like big tobacco, corrupted research around why we should eat more sugar and less fat. And so one way to think about the legacy of this is that for a community that has been the subject of economic exploitation, giving them access to cheap processed foods in segregated communities has been one way that we see the long tail of racial slavery and segregation in America.
Long indeed. We're just about out of time. Can you give me a quick thought on the importance, in your opinion, of the New York Times 1619 series to understanding American history better?
Well, first of all, it's an incredible provocation and one that couldn't be better timed, both to the anniversary and also to the politics of knowledge in this country. For all the criticisms on the right and left about the 1619 Project, the truth is we have incredible evidence of how badly American history is taught in our classrooms. It's still subject to the same kind of culture wars that have been going on for 30 years. And this is an opportunity for a major correction. Is it going to be led by the New York Times Magazine? Absolutely not. But it does call the rest of us to pay closer attention to what is being taught in our nation's classrooms.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad is a professor at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard and author of the book The Condemnation of Blackness. His essay in the New York Times 1619 series is called The Barbaric History of Sugar in America. Thank you so much for coming on. So interesting.
So great to be on. Thanks, Brian.
WNYC, and as Black History Month comes to a close this week, we're closing the show every day with contributors to the New York Times 1619 Project. 1619 as in the year enslaved Africans first arrived in what became the United States. Joining me for today is Linda Villarosa, a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. Her essay for the project is called How False Beliefs in Physical Racial Difference Still Live in Medicine Today. Linda, so nice to have you in here today. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And you write about how the racist beliefs that led to errors in medical science continue to influence care today. So this isn't just a history piece. One of the most persistent, according to your piece, is the myth that Black people are impervious to pain. Can you talk about where that myth came from?
Well, I open the essay with this story of an enslaved man named John Brown, who was tortured in the name of medical science. And he was put over a pit of hot coals in order to test his heat tolerance to create a cure for heat stroke. So then later, the same doctor, who he had been lent to a doctor as a guinea pig, wanted to prove that black skin was thicker than white skin, and really tortured this man using, you know, sharp instruments, fire, to prove this. He was so damaged that he couldn't work anymore. He escaped and wrote his biography in England. It was amazing. And his biography is beautiful, the way it's written. It's in his own voice and talks about this torture. And the assumption was is that black people really have extremely high pain tolerance. And so this was used in order to keep people enslaved, to justify whippings and beatings and things like that. But it seems so harsh and terrible, and it is. But the interesting thing to me was that it wasn't just regular people saying that. It was doctors and scientists who believed it and were using sort of medical jargon and medical journals to prove this. And the fact that it's this same kind of myth, not to the same degree, but still persists today in medical circles is scary.
How do you see it in medical circles today?
There was a study in 2016 that interviewed white residents and medical students and residents. And so it asked them to rate black and white pain, or to say, do black people feel pain differently? Do white people feel pain differently? As well as other physiological differences, including thickness of the skin. Are there more, do black people have more nerve endings? It was kind of like odd. Does the black blood coagulate differently? And a significant number of medical students and residents believed much of that mythology, even though some of it was so false as to be fantastical. It should be things that medical students shouldn't believe.
Another persistent physiological myth that you write about is the false belief that black people have weaker lungs. That also was used to uphold slavery, right?
Exactly. And it may have been first started by Thomas Jefferson as a throwaway line in his notes on the state of Virginia. And he just said it kind of casually, this idea of weak lungs. But it was picked up by doctors at the time, Southern doctors. And so it was kind of like used to justify slavery, but also push the idea that slavery was actually beneficial to enslaved people. And so the way that myth still persists today is there's an instrument called a spirometer. And it was used by one of the people who really pushed this idea during enslavement that enslaved people had weak lungs. And he used this to measure lung function with the idea that black lungs were 10 to 15% deficient. Mm. So even many of the modern-day spirometers still have that race correction of 10 to 15% that assumes that black lungs are weak.
Wow. And this man, Samuel Cartwright, who you write about, was a physician and professor at what is now Tulane University. So it's another example of what you were saying before. This wasn't just sort of, you know, ignorant lay people. These are people who were employed in the sciences and should have known better, or should have known how to look at things.
Yes, that's what is strange. And sometimes when I'm speaking about it, people laugh because some of Cartwright's ideas were so crazy. He believed that there was this physical problem called drapetomania, which caused enslaved people to escape, and he called it a disease. But I said this person was legitimized. He was a doctor in these times and a scientist, well-regarded.
One more. You read about the physician J. Marion Sims, who has been long venerated as the father of modern gynecology. Now, listeners to this station may know that, you know, from our coverage in 2018, or coverage in a lot of places, that he had a statue on Fifth Avenue along Central Park that the de Blasio administration had removed. So what is his legacy now?
So the idea that he was the father of modern gynecology was upheld for many years until it came out that he was using enslaved women, torturing them to perfect a kind of surgery to repair fistula. So once that came out, it was really at least partly due to activism by black women wearing medical robes in front of that statue, which was across the street from the New York Academy of Medicine, out there with blood-stained robes, gowns, saying, please, this is in honor of the main three women he tortured, Anarka, Lucy, and Betsy. There is a direct through line to today. In 2019, last November, there was a new study that came out that said black women are under-medicated for pain of cesarean section. So that's a reproductive surgery that Black women remain under-medicated when in pain, even though they complain more about the pain, or the pain may be higher. They receive less medical intervention and less pain management. So that, to me, is a direct through line to Dr. Sims.
What do you think the cause today would be of not giving the same pain medication to patients in the same condition?
It seems like, from what these studies say, that it's unconscious bias, that it's not something... You know, doctors don't go into medicine to do harm. In fact, they want to do no harm. So to see them harming people makes it seem like it's unconscious. They don't know. It's people different from them, different race, different class. And so they just don't have the same kind of sensitivity. And so unconscious or implicit bias training for medical providers is really sort of the going trend.
Another one that I've heard about, I'm not sure if it's in your article, is the perception that Black people tend to have higher blood pressure, and so doctors have at times seen high blood pressure in Black patients and said, well, that's normal for you.
Black people do have higher blood pressure, and so that's real. But I think the cause may be up in the air. Some people have said that it's a strict biological problem, when it may be in reaction to discrimination in society. The lived experience of being Black in America may be causing us to have higher blood pressure than other people of other races.
But saying normal for you, to the extent that that goes on or has gone on in the past, means that Black people with high blood pressure weren't getting the same treatment as white people with high blood pressure to control it.
Exactly. And so the bottom line is, you really cannot say a race of people have X, Y, or Z physiological differences. Medicine is individualized. But I think some questions you have to ask are, what are the stressors that may be causing some of these physiological problems?
And we will have to leave it there with Linda Villarosa, a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. Her essay for the 1619 Project is called How False Beliefs in Physical Racial Difference Still Live in Medicine Today. Very illuminating for people who didn't know. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we will continue through the end of the week with writers from the 1619 Project in this final week of Black History Month here on The Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as Black History Month comes to a close this week, we're closing the show each day with contributors to the New York Times 1619 Project. 1619 as in the year enslaved Africans first arrived in what became the United States. Joining me now is Jasmine Hughes, a story editor for the New York Times Magazine, who edited and co-wrote A History of Slavery for the 1619 special section in the Times print edition. Jasmine, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Happy Black History Month.
And to you. And we've been talking to reporters all week, as you know, about the project. But let's talk about the moment when it all started, 1619 itself, in Port Comfort, Virginia, a terribly inaptly named place for this. The first time enslaved Africans were brought to the United States. How did that happen?
I know. Port Comfort, I think, is what people would call ironic. So earlier in the year 1619, there was a Portuguese slave ship that was actually on its way to Mexico. It was filled with captive Africans from what is now Angola, but what was called then the kingdoms of Ndongo and Congo. While they were on their voyage, they were seized by two English pirate ships, and then the captured enslaved Africans were taken to Port Comfort, which later became the Virginian territory close to Jamestown. And we know about this because there's a letter from the colonist John Ralph, who said that a Dutch man of war arrived to the colony and brought, quote, not anything but 20 and odd Negroes, which the governor and Cape merchant bought for victuals or provisions.
Was racialized forced labor considered normal at that time?
No, not yet. So forced labor wasn't uncommon at this point, because Africans and Europeans have been trading goods and people across the Mediterranean for centuries. But none of this was based on race. But once the transatlantic slave trade was introduced, it began as early as the 15th century. That's when, you know, we started to see a system of slavery that was commercialized and racialized, as well as inherited from generation to generation.
Can you talk about the Catholic Church's role in the slave trade's origin in the 15th century? I know you wrote about that.
Yes. So it surprised me to find out that the Catholic Church actually endorsed slavery. They granted Portugal a monopoly on trade in West Africa and in Spain to colonize the New World and to spread the good word about Catholicism. So Mary Elliott, who I worked on this project with, who is a curator at the African American History Museum, mm-hmm. And I wrote about how Pope Nicholas V actually buoyed Portuguese efforts and issued a piece of legislation that affirmed Portugal's exclusive rights to territories it claimed around that West African coast. So all of this was done with the endorsement of the church in order to spread Catholicism.
And I'm reading from your material that Pope Nicholas V buoyed Portuguese efforts and issued the Romanus Pontifex of 1455, which affirmed Portugal's exclusive rights to territories it claimed along the West African coast and the trade from those areas. And yet that doesn't explicitly mention trade in human beings.
However, that piece of legislation granted the right to invade and plunder and, quote, reduce their persons to perpetual slavery. Again, they wanted to spread the good word of Catholicism, and I have here that the state of Spain issued a contract that authorized the direct shipment of captive Africans mm-hmm. for trade in the Spanish colonies.
And so it began with permission for Portugal and Spain to control the slave trade, as you've been describing, quickly spread to England, the Netherlands, France, Denmark, and your project at the time, 1619, has been a reckoning with how integral enslaved people were to the founding of this country and the institution of slavery. Why do you think the countries in Europe haven't really had something like this, or do you think they have?
You know, I'm not sure if I'm the best person to answer that question, but, you know, just from my personal opinion, I think that the African-American population in the United States actually obviously outweighs those in European countries, and I think that because we have such an education about slavery in elementary school and middle school that we sort of learn about it in this really sanitized way. And obviously, the point of the 1619 project was to have a more realistic exploration of what slavery was actually like. But because it's embedded into our school system, but in such a weird way, I think that we think about it and we talk about it, but we're not talking about it or thinking about it or dealing with it realistically. And mm-hmm. that is the root of the problem.
Now, Africa at the time that we've been talking about was ruled by monarchies who fought fiercely against the Portuguese. Let's rescue a name from the dustbin of history. Can you tell our listeners about Queen Nzinga?
Yes. So this is Queen Nzinga, who was a ruler in what we call present-day Angola. And as the Portuguese were trying to colonize her territory and capture her people, she fought against them to maintain the safety of her territory. She died in 1663, but by that point, she had actually made peace with the Portuguese, and her state began trading with them on equal footing. But she was one of the first, if not the first or only female ruler in that territory during that time, and she was known for being an incredibly powerful warrior and really shrewd ruler.
This week we talked earlier about Thomas Jefferson's misguided ideas that helped to uphold slavery, but we haven't talked about how people were actively trying to stop him. So going from resistance in Africa to resistance in this country, and one example is Benjamin Banneker, a free black mathematician and scientist who wrote to Jefferson, who was then the Secretary of State. You're familiar with what was in that letter, right?
Yes. So Benjamin Banneker was, as you said, like a highly achieved person. And so he wrote, and a black man. And so he wrote this letter to Thomas Jefferson, basically encouraging him to re-examine his prejudices against people of African descent. And Thomas Jefferson was essentially like, you're the exception to the rule. Like, you're incredibly talented. But he wasn't sure that there were many other black people who could match Banneker's intellect. And to go on, I mean, Jefferson openly speculated that black people were inferior to white people and actually advocated for the removal from U.S. territory at the time. And so Banneker really was trying to, you know, to show Thomas Jefferson that people of African descent were of equal intellect and of equal, you know, who deserved the same rights as he did. But, you know, Jefferson kind of wasn't buying it.
We're going to run out of time in a minute, and your phone is starting to break up anyway, but many of the writers for this project are a generation older than you are, I think it's fair to say. Do you think there was a generational difference in your understandings about slavery with so many contributors?
I don't think so. So I'm 28, and in talking to, and I'm a Black American, and in speaking to my parents who are in their early 50s, who were able to experience like television programs such as Roots, I think that there was a lot more focus for them. And then, you know, again, because there wasn't like a huge cultural moment around slavery when I was in elementary school, we sort of just glided over it.
And we leave it there with Jasmine Hughes, story editor for the New York Times Magazine, who edited and co-wrote A History of Slavery for the 1619 Broadsheet special section. You can find the article online titled A Brief History of Slavery That You Didn't Learn in School. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as Black History Month comes to a close, we've been closing the show each day this week with contributors to the New York Times 1619 Project. 1619 as in the year enslaved Africans first arrived in what became the United States. Joining me now is Anne Bailey, professor of history at SUNY Binghamton and author of The Weeping Time, Memory and the Largest Slave Auction in American History. Her piece for the 1619 Project is called They Sold Human Beings Here. Welcome back to WNYC, Professor Bailey. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
You
write,
how are you? I'm good. Thank you for asking. You write about how in 1808, Congress put a ban on the importation of enslaved Africans, but there was still a domestic slave trade?
Yes. So, you know, it's more than Congress, but starting from the on the British side, there was this ban on the Atlantic slave trade. So that's the abolition of the slave trade in 1807. And so Congress followed suit. So to say that technically speaking, there should have been no more slave trading across the high seas. But the fact is that that meant that now there was increased pressure and intensity placed on those enslaved persons in the United States who now could be bought and sold within a kind of a domestic trade. So that's why in the 1800s, that's why there is this incredible increase of the number of slave sales, as much as 1.2 million, we estimate, between 1760 and 1860.
And you're right, the sales took place all over the growing nation, in taverns, town squares, and train stations, on riverbanks, and by the side of the road. Can you talk about, if anybody could talk about this, how a sale would go from the perspective of an enslaved person?
Well, from the perspective of an enslaved person, first of all, they would never know the exact time or date this could happen. So you have to think about that level of uncertainty that you live with on a daily basis. You're living on a plantation, and you have, in many cases, you've tried to eke out some kind of settled family life. And that was one of the few bright spots of slavery, is the extent to which family life was really prized, and those relationships were so important to the enslaved. But at the same time, you know, if you're a mother or a father, you live with that the fear that at any point the slave owner could decide that they would like to sell your son or your daughter or sell you away from your children. So that's the first thing, that it's this great level of uncertainty that you live with and you try to mitigate, but there's no way to completely plan for that. Secondly, when the auction is announced, you know, you can imagine there are all kinds of levels of negotiations or decisions that are made. Should they run away? Should they stay and try to plead with, you know, literally plead to keep their family life intact? Most of that falls on deaf ears, as as you can imagine, because most slave owners, when they decide to sell slaves, it's for economic reasons. And they're doing it because they want to pay off a debt. They're doing it because they want to, you know, give money or a wedding gift to a child, a grown child. It's that kind of thing. They have their own objectives. And for the most part, they're not really considering the family lives of these enslaved persons.
And you're right that immediately after emancipation, some newly freed people went back to auction sites for a specific reason that was not obviously to relive that traumatic experience. Can you explain why they went back?
Well, you know, what we find when we look in the slave narratives, for example, is that, you know, whenever they mention where they were auctioned, this would, of course, have an indelible mark in their mind. So what's interesting about this, Brian, is that there are no markers for the most part. There are less than 50 sites across the country that are marked as auction sites or slave sale sites. But yet, you can imagine for the thousands of people who were sold, this would have been marked in their minds and hearts forever. So that's one issue. But the second thing is that, you know, very practical, from a very practical perspective, they're going to be looking for their people, as they say, right? They're going to be looking for their family members, and they're going to be looking for whatever clues they can find in that area, if that's the area where they were sold, or if they were fortunate to find out where they were going to be sold to. So if, for example, like in my book, The Weeping Time, there's an engaged couple that are separated and they're sold separately. So one goes to North Carolina, and you would imagine that a few years later at the end of the war that they would be looking for one another. They know that they went to North Carolina, and so that would be one clue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's not much of a clue,
yeah.
But it's something. If they had the name of the new slave owner, if they had the state, but if they didn't, they absolutely would consider coming back to the place where you know, this particular trauma took place, because at least they could start to find some kind of clues as to where to find their loved ones.
Wow. So for the last 5 months, I see you and your research assistants have looked through archives to try and expand the historical record about America's slave auction sites. How many have you found?
Well, we have found, well, first of all, we know that there are hundreds, if not thousands. You know, we know that just from the record, the fact that so many people were sold. And they can be found, you know, we will eventually be able to identify a whole lot more as we look at various different types of records. We chose to focus on slave narratives, and we chose to focus on an archive of digitized ads or advertisements that were placed in newspapers, so that as soon as the Civil War was over, what you had is that you had these enslaved persons placing ads in, you know, newspapers across the country, very simple ads saying, information wanted. We're looking for a sister who looks like X, Y, and Z. Last found, or we left her at this site where she was sold, etc. So we chose to look at those records first, because we thought to ourselves that that really gives the slaves agency, that really gives them that sense of, it's as if we're searching the way they were searching, right, with the information that they had.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, there are many other records and many other archives that we should be looking at in the future to be able to locate these various sites and to tell these great stories of these men, women, and children.
And in our last minute or so, I know you're right that after the Civil War, most former auction sites quietly blended into the main streets of today because of the desire to paper over the atrocities of the past, and many of these sites were forgotten. But then it's shocking what some of them may have been. Like after Thomas Jefferson's death, his estate sold 133 of his enslaved workers at two different auctions, and you believe that one of them was on or near the West Portico steps of Monticello, and that's exactly what's on the back of the nickel.
Yes, it is. Those famous steps, and, you know, when you go to Monticello, you know, you would typically hear about the stories, and you would have read about this if you read anything about about Jefferson, you know, famous people, you know, other presidents and past presidents and so forth would go up and down those steps. And you don't really associate these famous, beautiful steps with an auction, but it's quite likely or possible that an auction took place there. To Monticello's credit, they do acknowledge the auctions that took place on the property. Mm-hmm. But the other auction that was another part of Jefferson's property, that took place in downtown Charlottesville. And there is no specific mention of the fact that Thomas Jefferson's enslaved people
Just real quick, and I'm going to jump in because I want you to be able to tell our listeners what you're looking for their help with. Can you do that in 15 seconds?
I can. First of all, if anyone who's listening knows anything about other marked sites that for somehow we have not seen or we have not located, please let us know. If they know stories, including oral history stories, because we have ways of checking whether or not actual sales took place there, we hope they will get in touch with me directly or with the New York Times. abailey@binghamton.edu. A Bailey at binghamton.edu.
Professor of History.
Or to the Times.
Professor of History.
Or to the New York Times Magazine.
Right. At SUNY Binghamton and author of the book, The Weeping Time, Memory and the Largest Slave Auction in American History. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.